episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my co-host, researcher, and friend, John McKinnon, author of The Persuasive Preacher, The Gifted Prophet, and The Noble Politician. John, it's good to be back and to talk about all things failed. This is probably going to be one of the weirder episodes that you and I have done, but it's important. And I think for people who were never involved in these groups, who are watching and trying to learn more about the mindset of somebody, generally I get people who are contacting me about the mindset of somebody who has escaped a cult and they want to help them in one of the churches. I think to understand this subject that we're getting into today is probably one of the most important that you can examine, because most of these groups have spun off and their leader has claimed to be a prophet of some sort, maybe an apostle of some sort with prophetic gifting, or maybe just a fivefold minister with authoritarian and divinely inspired, or so-called, quote-unquote, divinely inspired sermons. They all claim to have some sort of a gift or a prophetic insight, and that's how it spins off into a destructive cult. That's why when they leave, they talk about the prophecy. Only as they leave and start to unravel what was in their head, many of them who are escaping suddenly realize it wasn't really prophecy, it was failed prophecy. And whenever one of these people who have escaped get into one of these normal, quote-unquote normal churches, and I'm quoting that because there are so many varieties of different denominational churches, each one of the denominational, not just ministers, but even lay members who want to help the group, some of them contact me, and the biggest question is this: John, whenever you read the Bible about prophecy, the Bible is very clear in its instructions to test the prophecies. If the prophecies do not come to pass exactly as claimed, then that person is not a prophet of God, or they're not speaking prophecy from God. Why do the people not do this? And it's an important question, because they don't. Whenever you leave these destructive groups, even long after leaving, they still, many of the people, are so burdened because they believe the person really to be truly a prophet. And in the case of Branham, as we've mentioned, some of the prophecies can't even be tested because they weren't even claimed until long after the event happened. And yet he still got them wrong, which is kind of funny. But all of that aside, it's important for this very reason. Prophecy to people who are in these destructive groups is not viewed in the same way as people who've not been influenced by them, in so much that prophecy, specifically failed prophecy, isn't viewed as a failure so much as it is a test to the people who are escaping, or to the people who are inside who might otherwise escape. It's a test to see who remains. That was really, really difficult for me to understand. When I discovered the first failed prophecy of Branham and I went to my grandfather, I really thought, oh my gosh, if one of them is wrong, can we say that he was a prophet of God? Because I'd read that scripture, but my answer that I got from my grandfather was really to suppress it. So excited to get into this. There's so much to say. I hope I can contain it to an hour. We'll see if we can.
John, it's good to be back and good to do another episode with you. We're probably on number 7 now on what we were talking about, how to start a cult. And on this one, we're going to continue. It's about a part 3 in a couple of series on why people, you know, stay with false prophecies and why they fail to leave the group when they realize that there's been a false pronouncement of something that never came to pass, you know, that their leaders clearly, you know, articulated that, you know, it was supposed to happen, and why people remain even more committed to these groups even after that. So we're going to look at the psychological things again somewhat, but go into more detail on what the prophecies actually were on some of these groups, and just show how, you know, we see today they're still in them and the groups are still thriving. And the groups will probably remain thriving because they've long forgotten that their leaders have, you know, proclaimed false prophecy. So I'm looking forward to these next episodes because this is where we can critically examine, you know, what these high control groups have prophesied and, you know, whether these prophecies really came to pass, and examine, you know, what it does to the psychology of the members of the group. We could actually, you know, spend a lot of time on this, and I'm going to try to reduce it down as much as possible, maybe only going over two episodes with it, because you could just go on and on with the numerous false prophecies. But so rather than doing that, you know, there's some things in the modern day prophets in the New Apostolic Reformation movement. It's kind of hilarious to watch them in action because they're far different than what happened in the past. They're much less formal, they're more spontaneous, and they come up with some pretty wild ideas nowadays. You know, anything from one prophet I've heard that visited a Christmas town in heaven, and also maybe having snowball fights with Frosty the Snowman, and then eating your house made out of candy or jello, and then having it regenerate. You know, we're not focused on the prophets who have only a few brain cells left, but we're focusing on those movements, you know, who claim to develop prophetic insight and, you know, gained a large following to the point of looking like a legitimate Christian congregation. And these groups, or their leader, you know, gets bold at some point in the movement's history, and they begin to make predictions about doomsday, and they begin to set dates about the end times or about themselves and prophesy of things to come, which brings down the showdown, you know, when that date finally arrives, you know, whether God really spoke to them or not. So it's kind of amazing to see this happen and the dynamics of that, because clearly when they set a date in their own lifetime or in even our lifetimes, we can observe it, you know, and watch whether or not it does come to pass. So we got a foundation in our last two episodes on why members would continue to support a group and continue to believe, even though the prophecy and the dates and the details, you know, are clearly shown to be false. And I'm going to mention some of these false prophecies today and even name the groups. But like we said, when a group does publicly speak in the name of the Lord, and they speak a prophecy and, you know, puts their stamp of approval on it, and I believe the public, like us, has the freedom and responsibility to examine it and see if it's really so and identify the group with the prophecy. It's fair game. So that would be true of any church or group who wants to claim special, you know, divine revelation even. If they really believe their prophecy, they should not be afraid to have it challenged and to see if it can stand the test of a true prophecy. And so I will say that, you know, regardless of any of these, whether any of these people stood in the public square, you know, in sackcloth and ashes and proclaimed, "Thus saith the Lord," with their pronouncements, you know, when they speak, believe, or preach and publish a prediction about an event to make it clear that they believe it, you know, to me, that's qualification enough to say it lies close to prophecy, even if they don't proclaim it in the name of the Lord in sackcloth and ashes. You know, prophecy is just predicting the future, and that's what they're attempting to do. And any false prophets also quick to promote things that they may get right, you know, as vindication of truth. But on the flip side, you know, everything they got wrong, you know, is usually forgotten. And, you know, a lot of these things, and the groups will mention, you know, they didn't start flourishing until after Darby's dispensationalism maybe came out in the 1830s, and when the end times became very a flurry of activity around that and study around the end times because of the teaching of the rapture and the coming of Christ. So then we see now these groups are trying to actually predict, you know, when it's going to happen. But there's been many variations and groups of Christianity over the last 2,000 years, in fact, and I'm sure there some of them are even similar to the ones we're discussing today in the last 200 years, which are most well documented in our time. And they also arose back in those days and claimed maybe to be the true Christian church, as these did. But I don't know why the date setters, you know, we're looking at today are similar in the date spread they put upon their prediction. But usually when they predict a date that we find, it's usually about 15 to 20 year spread on average, I found, from the time they publicly go forward with it until the time of the fulfillment. And most of the time, the date was well off after they've gone off the scene. So another interesting similarity of all these cult leaders is the fact that they have a heavy emphasis on doomsday, the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation, as well as the second coming of Christ. So when they get deep in the study of it, you know, they almost think they have it figured out. You know, a lot of us do, because I remember back when I was a young teenager, and, you know, it was my prayer to God to really understand the book of Revelation. You know, I was naive enough to think that I could discover something, you know, maybe no one else had seen, and because I believed my prayer. And then I see how men fall into these traps. And when you get counting into the 70 weeks of Daniel, then some of that interpretation is easy and just builds excitement because you feel like you're going to really discover something unique here that Bible prophecy is not really hard to understand. And so each of these men and women who developed their own church, you know, they each had a slightly different take on the second coming and the book of Daniel, the book of Revelation, the fate of the Jewish nation, the fate of the elect and non-elect. So I'm sure these men are not much different than all of us, except they eventually convinced themselves that they really had deduced when Jesus was returning with an actual date. You know, if they'd only realized that Jesus said no man knows the day or the hour, it might have helped them avoid all these controversies. You know, we look back at the message, and William Branham even went on to say during his predictions that Jesus didn't actually say no one could not know the year of Christ's return. And so that was his justification for setting the date of 1977.
There are many different people in many different circles of Christianity and even non-Christianity who are aware that William Branham falsely prophesied that the world was going to end in 1977, but those people are not the people who are in his religious following. I was one of the people who was on the inside, and I can say with certainty that while I knew that William Branham made the prediction, I did not view it as a failed prophecy, which is really interesting. There are many different ways in which a central figure will do this, and I've examined several different groups at this point. They all have one thing in common. Whenever they're giving a prediction that they know is probably not from God, internally they have to know, because they always give a caveat or an out. They will say things like, I believe with certainty, God has showed me that this is going to happen, unless this other thing happens. And that's one of the common tricks and gimmicks, if you want to call it that. And the other thing that they will do is they will try to qualify what they say and give it just enough leeway to go either direction, that if it goes in the right direction, it's a prophecy. If it goes in the wrong direction, in other words, if it doesn't turn out like they said, well, that was just my own personal prediction. And that's what Branham did. He said it was a divinely inspired prediction. You can find an example of that statement in his Church Age book when it talks about 1977. Well, a divinely inspired prediction is a prophecy. There's no two ways about it. You are divinely inspired, meaning God has showed you that this is going to happen. Well, that's what he said. And leading up to 1977, his following believed it so strongly that there were publications. That, in fact, there was a book called By 1977. I've got a copy of it in there. They believed it hook, line, and sinker. And then what happened is when 1978 came, suddenly they realized, well, that was just a personal prediction. That was not a prophecy. And so I avoid that conversation entirely. There are better examples of failed prophecies that are much easier to show a person who is leaving the Branham religion. In fact, there is a prophecy that William Branham admitted to have failed. We've talked about that before, the India prophecy. But the 1977 prediction, as they call it, which was a prophecy, they will skirt around it in many different ways. Interestingly, you'll find the same thing even with the one that Branham admitted to have failed. He himself admitted that the prophecy failed, but I have had people contact me on the website and say, no, John, that didn't fail. It was fulfilled in this other way that wasn't the way that he said it would be fulfilled. So there is always a way in which the group can change or alter the statement, and it becomes a proving ground. If you can believe it, even though it failed, you have greater faith than the person who doesn't believe it. So therefore, you are a more devout follower of whatever is the movement.
That's so correct, John, and it's right on point, you know, as we go through this. You know, even back in the days of Sir Isaac Newton, you know, he was known for he was a scientist and very brilliant man, a Christian. And I'm sure as he started looking at the book of Daniel, he even probably believed he could decode, you know, the dates and the times and when these things were going to happen. And so it's easy to fall into that. So during the Second Great Awakening in America, which was in the 1800s, there was a lot of religious fervor in the U.S. at that time. And like I said, Darbyism dispensationalism had also came about and came to the U.S., and it clouded beliefs in the end times in America, and eventually gained a large following even in the Christian church, because around 1909, we found it becoming firmly entrenched in American society and evangelicalism because the Scofield Bible was published. C.I. Scofield, he systematized Darby's ideas and put them directly into that Bible text as notes. And so it entered America through that channel around the mid-19th century, around 1840 to 1870. And so during this time, a Baptist lay preacher named William Miller, you know, this is one of our first groups we'll look at here, he spent years of intensive study of the symbolic prophecies of Daniel and counted the 2300-day prophecy. And so Miller got to where he believed that the cleansing of the sanctuary, you know, represented earth's destruction by fire at Christ's second coming. And so he used a year-a-day method of prophetic interpretation, which started around 457 B.C. with the decree to rebuild Jerusalem by Artaxerxes of the first of Persia. So he just calculated it and indicated that this period would end about 1843. And it's amazing how we can calculate these events, and they always end about the time, you know, we find them to end about the time we're alive. And so it amazes us. So a simple calculation amazed him that he was living about that time and that he might get to see these things. So around 1831, he published an article in his tracts and periodicals that were sent about. And it took about 9 years for this to gain hold and gain momentum, because this was back in the days, you know, we didn't have internet. We had the Pony Express, maybe the horse and buggy. It took a long time for ideas to travel. So 9 years, not a long time, much slower than today, which could be immediate. So after about 9 years, around 1840, you know, Millerism, as it became to be known, was transformed from an obscure, you know, regional movement into a national campaign, actually. Miller was actually become in high demand to explain this prophecy. And as the various dates of Christ's predicted return approached, you know, Millerite publishing gradually increased. Around 1843, 21,000 copies of Millerite papers were published every week. In New York, in a five-month period, in 1843, about 500,000 copies of various publications were distributed. In December of 1843, there was a publication proposed by the group of about 1 million tracts. And in May of 1844, he even announced that 5 million copies of Millerite publications had been distributed about that time. And they went up into Canada and even Great Britain. So you see, the publishing of their ideas tends to gain momentum. And you can imagine what happened in the Scofield Bible as it got into the homes of people and they read it, how much those ideas, you know, lash into people's brains even to this day. You know, William Miller didn't express a specific date, but he narrowed the time frame between March of 1843 and March of 1844 for Christ's coming. But eventually that date, of course, passed, you know, no incident. But most Millerites at that time retained their faith. They didn't leave the movement. And Miller expressed continued expectations, saying that Christ's going to return at any moment. And so the movement kept surviving after this because the leaders kept being flexible on the timing, allowing for minor calculation or historical errors to come into play there. And so they just kept being in expectation. And that's generally what these groups do, is they keep you in high expectation for something about to happen. And in fact, they get you so much on the edge of your seat that if you felt like if you'd leave, you're going to miss it. So then a new date was set after that, and it was based off a different Jewish calendar, and that passed without fulfillment. And that led to a belief into a tarrying time of waiting. And that sustained the movement for a while till about July of 1844. And their evangelistic fervor declined at that time. But about August, another minister named Samuel Snow introduced the seventh month or midnight cry message. He concluded that Christ would return October 22nd of 1844 using the Jewish Karaite calendar. And that spread rapidly, as you can imagine, because everybody's, you know, all expectation. and it was faster spreading than any prior Millerite teaching at the time. And even major leaders were caught off guard with this teaching, such as Miller and a man named Himes. Most didn't accept that date until late September or early October, and there was a lot of confusion. And what this whole year became to be known was called the Great Disappointment. And then all these members of the group, it seemed like almost every one of them had a different opinion, and all of them were different. But after that, the movement fragmented into distinct groups, each interpreting the failure differently. And so there was major groups formed after this. Now I can relate this to the message. You know, after 1977, or even after 1965, the prophet dies, and 1977 comes to pass, and nothing happens. But each time this happens, the groups just splinter in all different directions because everyone's trying to understand the prophecies that were given and trying to interpret them in light of what's happened. And so it causes that to happen. And that's what we see in these groups. So no different in this Millerite movement. It formed the Seventh-day Adventist Church eventually, and they interpreted something as Christ entering the heavenly sanctuary. It became the investigative judgment, not his return to earth. They retained the historicist prophecy and rejected dispensationalism at that time. They emphasized Saturday Sabbath keeping, and key figures at that time were Ellen White, James White, and Joseph Bates. So, interesting at this time, they latched onto that October 22nd day of 1844, and they said the door of salvation for the world had closed. They believed the probation had ended for those who rejected the Millerite message. And so the key figures that held that temporary view were Ellen G. White in her earliest writings, James White, and Joseph Bates. So the shut door was present in the spiritualizers also, and that was short-lived as well, which said that Christ had already returned spiritually in 1844. And this was all quickly faded and rejected by most Millerites. So you see these different splinter groups had their own interpretation of what happened. And I likened what they said about salvation of the world had closed. Now, a lot of the people in the message in 1863, you know, taught that as well. I'll go through that in a minute. This belief was popularized, say, by a couple of Millerite people. You know, they got into the parable of the 10 virgins, mentioning the door being shut. And so that happened there. And so they became known as the shut door spiritualizer group, believing that further calls to repentance were not even necessary. So the shut door teaching that came about as a result of all this, you know, I think back in William Branham's group saying that salvation closed after 63 when the seven seals were revealed, when supposedly Jesus stepped on earth and said, "Time shall be no more." But that was later abandoned as in the Millerite movement as well as the Message movement as conversions kept happening. And nowadays we say that, you know, God is still converting people in the Message. It's not over. And because you have to eventually say that. It's been 60 years now. So how long is God going to keep that door shut and let people be born and never have a chance at salvation when the gospel is still going forth?
You know, that's something that I don't think many people think through, not just the people who are inside the group, but I'm talking about even the people who are outside looking in. They don't think through that as closely as they should. It isn't just the failed prophecy that is concerning. When people are on the outside and they want to look in and see, was this a false prophet? They'll go directly to the prophecies and say, are these prophecies from God? In other words, we're going to test them. Did all of the details come true exactly as they said? Can I find one single detail that failed? If I did, it's a false prophet. That's usually the direction they go. But remember, in these destructive groups, the prophecy itself isn't all-encompassing. It is just the foundation for the doctrine that's built on top of that prophecy. And as you just mentioned, Branham did build theology on top of his doomsday prediction that closed the doors to the gospel. In other words, his group had it. They had the message. That's what he called it. That's why it's called the message. This message was the new gospel. And there's no need really to go out and recruit new members because this is it. The door has closed. We're in the ark, so to speak, and the doors are shut on the ark. Everybody on the outside is doomed. That was really the theology. That theology was based upon these predictions, these false prophecies. So when you're outside of the group and you're looking in, you also need to examine, does the theology that's built on top of the prophecy match the themes that we find in the New Testament? Because that's really the key. Does this support the furthering of the gospel, or is this something that actually hinders the gospel from spreading? That's really, really important to look at. It took me years after leaving to understand that concept, and I did have people try to explain it in different ways, but my head was so wrapped around just the prophecies themselves that I didn't think of all of the many things that were built on top of it. It's another reason why people say, whenever you leave a group, that the people on the inside will say, well, if that wasn't the true prophet of God, tell us which one is. They always go that direction because there are so many themes built on top of the prophecies. They must have a prophet or the whole thing crumbles. Every theology really crumbles. You don't have a messenger for the age, for example. All of that theology fails. So for me, that is one of the most important points that we're probably going to bring up in this podcast. Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the latter rain, charismatic, and other fringe movements into the new apostolic reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support.
Yeah, John, we see these cults forming all around this kind of hype and, you know, predictions that happen and fail. And so even another group that was later developed and was influenced by the Millerite movement was called the Bible Student Movement. And this is where we got Jehovah Witnesses coming out of that. So they drew from the Adventist chronological interest, but they were theologically very distinct in their own way. They adopted a new prophetic system and dates totally unrelated to Millerism. But it was founded by Charles Russell, of course, but they were influenced by the Second Adventist thinkers. And what the Jehovah Witnesses will say is that the prophet is not just one man, but it's a body of people. And that's where they get their Watchtower Tract Society, is that it's a body of people deciding, you know, what's truth. But they had major prophecies as well that came and went. They predicted in 1874, they said that Christ returned invisibly. And then in 1897 said that the appointed king is now present. In 1878, they predicted saints would be taken to heaven. And then in 1876, of course, Russell adopted the Adventist-derived view that Christ parousia or presence or return began invisibly in 1874. And so they kind of gathered in their own little group there, and they kept setting dates and dates. One of the major dates that's well known in Jehovah Witness history is 1914, which they established as the end of the world. And it was spoken about 1899, so about 15 years earlier. And that's where they said the battle of the great day Almighty, it would end in 1914 with the complete overthrow of Earth's present rulership. And it was already commencing. So I can imagine that World War One was very influential in their beliefs because it was taken to be fulfillment. So we see that when groups make prophecies, they look for current events to vindicate what they're saying. So just like William Branham's prophecy of a woman being president, and just because, you know, Kamala wore purple, and he said the woman's arrayed in purple, well, that was immediately, you know, taken to be that's the fulfillment of the prophecy. So we look for confirmation bias in our current events, and it's very heavy in the mind. So any little thing that shows up that appears to be like it's a fulfillment, they take as a fulfillment. In 1918, the Jehovah Witness determined that the destruction of churches and governments would be happening, and they were confidently marking the return of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and the prophets back to the earth. And they even built a building for them to live in. So around 1925, they predicted the resurrection of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then when it finally came, he said, many Christians have looked forward to this year. They've confidently expected that all members of the body of Christ will be changed to the heavenly glory. So many other things happened. In 1966, the Watchtower Society issued what became a sequence of statements on a new date, 1975. And that raised the possibility of that year heralding the beginning of Christ's millennial reign and doom for unbelievers. So as it drew closer, a degree of uncertainty became apparent in the Watchtower publications. And then they started saying it was probably feasible, apparent, appropriate. But then at the end of 1968, it became just a possibility. And as more and more time went on, you know, they became less and less confident that anything was going to happen. Some of their catchphrases about that time was stay alive till 75. You know, it urged members to maintain their meeting attendance or you're going to lose your life at Armageddon. So there was a Dutch social anthropologist named Singelenberg, and he found that amid that conflict within those statements from an era about what might happen that year, they had a sense of urgency on there on a probable apocalyptic event, and then later the possibility of a cataclysm. The expectations of that significant event in 75, it had a real big impact on their proselytizing activities and on the membership growth. So John, I believe that's the key to the whole thing, is that the more hype and the excitement you can build about something fixing to happen, you know, it feeds the group, it feeds their expectations, and it raises it up to a high level to where they start proselytizing. Then they stick closer to the group. It has a great psychological effect. They create high expectations among the faithful members, and then that fury of emotions and activity and evangelism keeps them in the group because they believe it's going to save their souls. And one elder in the group of Jehovah Witnesses actually told Singelenberg, said it was good. This was after the event didn't take place. He said, it was good that Armageddon didn't take place because now it separated the wheat from the chaff. So they find ways to explain it away. And we're going to see this over and over here as we go through this.
That's the other key thing to understand. They find ways to explain it away. It's not just that. Yes, that is what's happening truly. But if you really think about what's actually happening underneath the hood, it turns out that whenever there's a failed prophecy, it's more than a bad prediction. This is where the failed prophecy itself becomes a system. In other words, the prophecy created the urgency before it fails, and then after the failure, it starts to create loyalty after the failure because they start to build doctrines on top of it as to why it's okay that it failed. So prophecy itself, like I said, it becomes this loyalty test. You can test whether or not you were a good seed or a bad seed, a wheat or a tare, however they want to frame it. But then those who stay, those who remain, they get the special secret. They get the explanation as to why that prophecy was more important, even in its failure, than the original. In other words, we had all this hype building up to it. We were focused on it. It came, it went, it didn't happen. Well, here's why that didn't happen. Did you know people? And they start to explain it. That happened with 1977 as one of the talking points. But if you go to the website, I've listed several of the different doomsday predictions. It wasn't just 1977. This was a repeating theme. And yes, it was closely tied to the fears of the war and the fears of a third world war. They would say things like, this is it, folks, 1956. You have to make your decision. There is no more time. They would say things like this. Well, that's okay when that's opinion, but then when you match that opinion with, here's the prophecies as to why I made that opinion, that blurs the lines between what is prophetic and what's just a personal opinion. And then when you build theology that weaves all of that together, now you have woven your personal opinion into divinely inspired prophecy. And once those two emerge, you can't separate them. So in the people's minds, they have now linked the failed prophecy with the all of the predictions, and they've linked the claim, the out. Whenever they give the prediction, they say, this will happen thus and thus unless. Well, once that's linked, you can't really go down the unless path. So even though there is an out, and with 1977, William Branham had one, the people didn't care because all of that theology was preparing them for the end of days. So they would come up with things, for example, like they would say, God, through his grace and mercy, has extended the time. Or they would say, we weren't ready yet. We need to get ready first. So all of these different theologies are built on top of the failure, and the failure becomes more powerful than the prophecy itself.
So John, once again, we just see over and over, you know, how these the hype and the excitement that builds in members, you know, they can find ways to explain it away. And right now we're going to look at something that has impacted message believers, anybody in any of these groups. You know, when they really have that strong belief and they're holding on to it with all they have, and they think the end's going to happen, you know, they do a lot of crazy stuff. You know, they're not counting this, we're going to be here another 10 years. So they tend to do some things they wouldn't normally do. And I'll mention one testimony from a Jehovah Witness that was in the movement in their early 70s. And then he found it impossible to remain an active member after their failure in 1975. But he said that he, like many others, had been convinced the world would come to an end in 75. He said, I said it from the platform. We told everyone the end was near. He said, when I became a witness, I gave up my insurance policies. I canceled all my insurance endowments. I never bought a house because I knew I wouldn't need one. We didn't even want to put the kids' names down for school. So the response of each of these prophetic failures by the Watchtower Society followed this general pattern, you know, amongst believers. And this was from Joseph Zeigmund. He's also one that studied the group. He said the initial reaction by both rank and file and the movement's leaders was usually a combination of disappointment and puzzlement. And that's usually what happens. You get your hopes built up for the rapture to occur, for the end to come, and then you're disappointed. Then you wonder, how could he be wrong? So it creates puzzlement. And then your proselytism declines. But the members that are still there, they remain in an attitude of watchful waiting as for these predictions to materialize. It's the same way in the message. We don't see near the proselytizing that happened back in the early 60s, 70s, and 80s. The excitement is just not there. But the members that are still there, they're waiting and watchful for things to materialize. But the doctrinal basis for the prophecies are re-examined, and then conjectures are offered as to why these events might have been delayed. You know, we would say that, well, Jesus hasn't come back because we're receiving an extra measure of grace. The door of mercy is remaining open because there's more to come in. And, of course, that's true. God is keeping that door open because he expects to bring in a lot more people. But not just to the message, of course. It's to his people as Christians in general. So then the group asserts that the prophecies had been partially fulfilled, or that some event of prophetic significance, something supernatural and not open to any kind of confirmation, you know, really transpired behind the scenes on these dates that were set. So the belief becomes God's plan is continuing to unfold within our group. And then unfulfilled portions of the prophecies were projected way into the future by reissuing either a new date or a retrospective interpretation of earlier failures. So we take in the message, you know, we take, there's people that believe that William Branham will come back and fulfill shooting of a brown bear, for instance, or take a tent and go around the country and have tent revivals. I mean, that's a very common belief. And that's gradually gone away but there's probably still some that still probably hold to that. So this man, Zygmunt, concluded that the group's faith in its own belief system provides a basis for the claim of fulfillment, and the selective perception of global events, which are current events, they furnish supportive empirical evidence of fulfillment. So in this sense, and he said, and to the extent, the prophecies just cannot fail. Unfulfilled prophecies were converted into partial successes, welcomed as divinely provided lessons revealing God's purposes more fully, yet it was accepted that each of these prophecies would eventually come to pass. Thus you have return ministry in William Branham's movement. So in actuality, it doesn't matter what the leader prophesies, because members that are fully dedicated and fully have given their lives over to this will find a way to show that the prophecies have not indeed failed. You know, for people whose lives have become dominated by this powerful expectation, and their activities and daily lives are dictated by what this belief requires, you know, the abandonment of faith because of disappointments about some date that was set, it would usually be too traumatic an experience, you know, for them to contemplate. And that's why we see these movements survive, because in their minds it's just too traumatic. You know, so we could understand why these movements last a long time. We just hope that the truth that we're bringing out in this day, presenting, you know, all the issues, that new people will not join these movements because of the issues there, the you know, the false prophecies and so forth. But that the only thing that's holding the group together may be the birth of new children within the groups. But we hope that the information that's out in the world today, that people can, you know, find their way, even though these groups will continue to survive at least for a good while yet.
And that's just it. It is a never-ending battle. When people first leave, they start to say to themselves, well, I just discovered the truth. This person was lying to me. This group was lying to me. There were so many things wrong with it. Why can't people see this? And they really struggle to recognize the fact that there is a deep level of groupthink. And whenever something is a failure, when something is clearly wrong, that failure becomes more powerful than actually the thing that was wrong in the first place. The doctrines that are built on top of the failure are like Band-Aids. So the more you stack the Band-Aids, the more you wrap the Band-Aids, you can take a cut. And if you wrap enough Band-Aids, your skin is actually harder through all of the layers and layers of plastic. Well, that's what they do with these failed prophecies. They'll add doctrine upon doctrine upon doctrine. In the end, I've mentioned that it's kind of like trying to peel an onion. Whenever you leave a group, you peel off this layer that you found was false. Well, what you find is underneath that layer, there's another false layer. So you have to peel it off. And by the end of your peeling off, you realize that you either end up with something that's just so incredibly absurd, you would never have followed it in the first place, or you find that there was nothing there at all. So these layers of protection over the false thing are actually the binding that holds the group intact.
You know, I want to go through the reasons why these groups survive, you know, why, and it's very common to all these groups when you have failures of prophecy. Why do they continue to survive? Because we said they're going to continue on for a while. And I'm going to give a good example, you know, in the message movement. But in Jehovah's Witnesses, it's said that what they did was reinterpret the vision. They called it an invisible spiritual fulfillment of a vision, or the date setting versus the actual thing happening. There's also, in these groups, you have authority control. So there's very centralized leadership that binds everybody together. And so to leave the leadership of the local church or the pastor to disagree with the headquarters, say, you know, you're out. So there's authority control. That keeps the groups together. There's information restriction. And we find in this day, the information restriction is so much less, thank goodness, because you can get access to the information if you really want it. But back then, in the days when we were kept in the dark, any information that came out, say that was contrary to the Bible message, that was restricted from the rank and file people, including us. So we never had access to the information to be able to make good decisions why we were even in the group. Then there's identity fusion is what they call it, is salvation tied to the organization. So to leave the group is to leave, you know, the salvation that's guaranteed in the group. And then you're called an apostate. Then there's blame shifting within the group, you know, as they separate and splinter in their own little belief systems. You know, they would say members just misunderstood the expectations. And that aligns, all these things align perfectly with that book we discussed earlier, with all these dynamics that were described in the book called When Prophecy Fails. So we find that that's the dynamics of what's happening there. So the bottom line with Jehovah's Witnesses is one of the most documented examples in history of repeated false prophecies spanning over 140 years. But with each failure, they followed it along with a doctrinal revision rather than repenting of the error and getting in line with true Christianity. We're going to find that is exactly what happened within the message. Many message people they're not even aware of these things because they did happen early on in William Branham's ministry. He mentioned it as early as 1952, you know, right after his South Africa trip that was so successful. Many people were there, had a big meeting. So after that, as his popularity began to decline, he came up with a new vision, and we know it as the, you know, Africa-India vision. We also know another one called the Tent Vision, which I'll go through that here just a little bit, because he believed very strongly that he was going to have a gospel tent and even have a little room inside the tent that he would minister personally to people, and they would come in and go out totally healed. So as that Tent Vision, you know, failed to materialize as far as reality, then it became more interpretive of the things we've gone through today. I'm going to read some things that show you exactly what people are saying about it today, whereas back then, you know, William Branham had gone to people and said, okay, I want you to be the truck driver. He said, we're going to acquire this tent, and they actually may have even bought a tent. There's some that bought an airplane that he mentioned he was going to fly around on. As the truck driver took the tent from place to place, he would fly in this airplane. So they had it all in place for this vision to be fulfilled at the time. But of course, it never materialized. So read a little bit here in 1956 when he actually had this vision. He said, he'd taken me from there, the angel. He said, I seen a great huge tent. Never seen such a tent. It was packed and lined with people everywhere. And he says, I walked out, looked like it was standing above people looking down where I just made an altar call. Hundreds and hundreds of people were weeping, rejoicing, accepting the Lord Jesus as their Savior. That he said that Brother Ward would build a tabernacle down in this position, this direction here, just exactly, you know, old timers. He's referring back to maybe a vision he had of Brother Ward building a tabernacle. He said, it happened just that way, and so will this be. He's talking about the tent, for it's thus saith the Lord, as you know. So he's relating the tent vision as coming to pass as material as this tabernacle, he said, that would be built for a Brother Ward, because he said it was thus saith the Lord. He says, and now I believe I'm at the brink of the greatest meetings ever I've ever held for the Lord, laying right in the future. And that was in January of 56. And then 2 years later, he still mentions this. He says, after a couple of nights, I want to start in on my new ministry. I want to take them back here in this room because you know the vision. How many remembers the vision? Sure you do, a little tent in the room. He said, but a ministry I can't be let known to the public. No one will ever duplicate this. He said, I feel like I can reach out and take it here. And that was in 58 in September. And then in 62, he continues to mention the tent vision. He says, as far as I know, every vision that's ever given me been fulfilled, except one that I'm a change in my ministry where I'm to pray for people in a little place, a little room under a tent, a big auditorium or something. It looked like to me a tent. So all these things that were mentioned, he really felt like he was going to have a tent. But after that was not fulfilled, and after he died in 65, without that large-scale tent ministry going forth, then the views start disintegrating rapidly into different sects of, you know, people believing different things. You know, some see it as an unfulfilled in a literal sense, and that's why they might have a return ministry. And then, but they complete it through Branham's overall ministry. They believe it happened. Others interpret it symbolically or even spiritually as if already fulfilled. Critics to the movement viewed as a failed prophecy. But then faithful ministers emphasize a spiritual fulfillment over a literal fulfillment. So here's some key things that were said by different ministers. Of course, one was, of course, Raymond Jackson of Faith Assembly that Charles has talked about very much. He stated that Branham fully completed his ministry as the end time prophet. There's no need for him to resurrect or fulfill visions like a tent. And so he rejected the carnal interpretations or expectation of a return ministry, or riding a white horse, or attributing unfulfilled aspects, you know, to people's attitudes, similar to how Moses' journey was affected by Israel's unbelief. You know, Moses couldn't go into Promised Land because of something he did when he struck the rock. He emphasized that Branham's role ended with his death, and that any unresolved prophecies, including the tent, should be tested against Scripture. So he had sort of a balanced view. And he did not believe he would come back, believe it was fulfilled in his lifetime in some way. Now, Perry Green believed that the vision was literal, but unfulfilled during his life, leading him to attempt to realize it by purchasing a large tent after 1965. And he recounted Branham expressing uncertainty at one point about the literal tent. And he quoted William Branham as saying, "Brother Perry, I don't know whether it was a tent." But Green saw it as a prophetic promise for a continued message ministry, not as a failure. Framed it as assurance, when all doors are closed, you can have the tent. He positioned the vision as part of end-time events, but acknowledged it shifted to a symbolic place for preaching in opposition. So that was another way it was interpreted. There's another pastor, Brother Jesse Smith. He's also a message believer and a preacher. He argues the vision was fulfilled symbolically, you know, during Branham's private revelations of the seven seals in March of 63, rather than a physical tent. And the reasons why is because he said it was not a public show. The third pull was private. And the other thing was a prayer closet interpretation. A little room was a secret place, being shut in a room with the shades pulled for study and visions happening during the revelation of the seven seals. Also, supernatural miracles. He said that healings occurred that week. Say a boy with leukemia and a dying child, you know, matches the vision's miracle. So he has that way of interpreting it. And also salvation, because he led the preaching of the seals led to over 100 baptisms in the name of Jesus Christ, fulfilling the mass salvation scene. So he interprets it that way, that the seven seals was the fulfillment of the tent vision. Another pastor down in Alabama, Brother Shelley, he interprets the vision as fulfilled through supernatural anointing or a spiritual pavilion for the end-time bride, not as a physical structure. So he also had a vision that told him the tent symbolized a stretched anointing preparing believers for a translation faith, making them just like Jesus. So in a sense, he's saying is for all believers, message believers, and it'll be stretched upon all believers in a spiritual way. And in the broader message community, the views are mixed. You know, some express full belief in a literal fulfillment, but then question it because of Branham's death. There's puzzlement there. And so it leads to debates on whether it was symbolic or yet to come. And so all kinds of beliefs happen because of it. But anyway, so as we get through this, that's just one example of how when somebody declares a vision to be thus saith the Lord or a date setting, you know, we have to recontextualize it after it doesn't happen the way we expect it to happen. So these visions will continue to be debated year after year after year, and we'll come up with more and more ways to, you know, spiritualize it, because we don't believe he's coming back to fulfill these things now, of course. And there's no way he's going to have a tent and go around in an airplane. It's just not going to happen. So they do find ways to explain it away. And so as we go through more and more of these false prophecies that were proclaimed by these groups, and especially the message, that'll be in our next episode, we're going to see very clearly that, you know, there's a dichotomy here. These things did not happen. So you either have to put yourself in a position to say, you know, what do I do from here? if you're like most people within these groups that can't seem to come out because they're mental block and it's just too painful, you're going to stay within the group and figure out how to explain it away. But if you're of those that, who want the truth and realize that there's something wrong when somebody's proclaiming a prophecy in the name of the Lord that doesn't happen, then I think it's the ones that will be more wiser to question it and look at the evidence. And that's all we're asking people to do here is look at the evidence, you know, what has happened. Don't spiritualize it and don't try to explain it away. But these things are very important to the people. So that's all we're trying to do here is trying to get them to look and use their critical thinking and not just be going along with the group just because they say it's so.
Absolutely. You know, people often mistake what I'm doing as attacking the group or the people who are in the group of the different various groups that we talk about on this podcast. It isn't really that so much as I am advocating that they use critical thinking, because it really doesn't matter what church you're in. You could go, for example, to a, and I won't mention a denomination, I don't want to point people in one direction or other, but say you're going to a denominational church that has a good reputation, you go to a service where there's a minister that has a good reputation, you start attending, 10 years from now, something happens and something changes within inside of him. Maybe there's a mental health issue, maybe he went through a bad experience, but the church starts to shift. If you're not using critical thinking, then suddenly you're caught up in that. You're in the group, and it is, maybe it was a benign group, maybe it was a healthy group, who knows? But suddenly it starts to change unhealthy. That's really the problem. If you're not engaging critical thinking about what's being said, they can take you anywhere. So my point in doing all of this is not really to drag people out, but just if you're inside of the group, make the people start thinking a little bit. Wake up and at least examine what you're in and why. But my focus is actually for people who are outside the groups. I want them to get the correct history, not the group's altered histories, because part of what we've explained is the failed prophecy, the failed predictions, it rewrites the DNA of the group. And as you're rewriting the DNA and you're stacking all of these doctrines on top, well, eventually there comes to be a layer where now you have really forgotten the reason why you created all these band-aids for your theology, and the original reason, the original failure, gets erased. And so my point in doing all of this is really just to document what happened so that researchers can find it. And anyway, this is there's so much more I could say. We'll get into it next time. I think we've only skimmed the surface of this particular subject. So if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the information about Roy Davis and William Branham, you can read The Persuasive Preacher, The Gifted Prophet, and The Noble Politician. And for more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.